What is real? What is true? Is reality really real? When I breathe in, is it oxygen that fills my lungs? Do I interact with the physical world, or do I merely think that I'm interacting with the physical world? Is blue blue? Is softness soft? Is hardness hard? How can we know the world around us? What is true? Can truth be known? Can absolute truth be known? Is truth limited to observation? There's a chair there. Or is it limited to objective verification? 2 + 2 = 4. What about more complex issues? How could one believe or be justified in believing something like Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, that Seattle is also known as the Emerald City? What is truth and what is real? As I've asked you guys and compelled you guys to ask yourself these questions, you've realized that these are very complex issues. And now you realize why, for thousands of years, people have been talking about the nature of truth and the nature of reality. What is real and what is true? So, where do we begin this quest for knowledge? Do we begin with truth or reality? Now, before I answer this, I would like to do two quick things. Last week, I had a person ask me about, you know, I was like, well, you know, this is a, we're here at a church service, and what about Jesus? You know, because we didn't open a Bible last time, and we didn't talk about Jesus last time. And I think that's an excellent question to bring up, because anytime you go to a service and people are, you think maybe you're not preaching the word, yeah, you need to call them out on it. Now, let me ask you this. In the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus said, when you fast, you know, do not be like the hypocrites, what did he do after that when he said that? No cheating.
Oh, you said it.
Yeah. What did he do? Did he say, when you fast, you should not be like a hypocrite? Is like, for they love to fasting at street corners and synagogues. He says that. Notice what he doesn't do is say, when you fast, oh, by the way, okay, this is what fasting is. Fasting is when you, for an extended period of time, go without food. Now, during this time, you can be very weak. If you get weak, make sure you're drinking lots of water. Make sure you're not doing strenuous activity or making yourself. Did he go in and explain all of those things? No, he didn't. Why not?
Because people knew what fasting was.
Exactly. Now, if I were to teach fasting to you guys, and I have, can I just say, when you fast?
No, because we don't do it on a regular basis.
Exactly. We, as a culture, have lost the art of fasting. We do not know what to do if we get, if we don't feel well. We don't know how to begin, like the meal to have before a fast. We don't know the meal to end a fast. We don't know any of those things. But when Jesus talked about them, when he talked about it, he just mentioned it because they knew exactly what he's talking about. Same thing with truth. Jesus says, you know, you want to know what truth is? I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but through me. Now is a time where truth is being attacked in a way that's never really been attacked before, with this newer skepticism. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And so what I'm doing is equipping you to defend the gospel. But in order to do that, I need to teach you guys about truth and reality. Now, in Scripture, we are commanded to defend the faith that was passed down once for all by the saints. Incumbent in that, in defending that, it does no good to defend the gospel if you cannot defend truth. Because you can talk about the gospel, you can talk about Jesus Christ, you can talk about evidence for the existence of God, but if someone comes back at you and says, that's your reality, If someone comes back at you and says, that's your truth, and you don't know how to respond to that, then you are not being a faithful steward in defending God's word. So yeah, at first it seems like, what good is it to talk about these subjects? Why should I need to know about truth? Why should I need to know about reality? Because ultimately, they will enable you to preach the gospel and to defend the faith that was passed down once for all by the saints. So that is why, and I should have mentioned this last time. Actually, it's in my notes, and I just didn't mention it. Or it was, I don't remember if it was in my notes or not. But anyways, I wanted to talk about it. So you might be asking yourself, you know, why are we talking about this? The reason why we're talking about it is because it's crucial to defend the faith. Also, the other thing I want to talk about before we get started is I just want to define a couple terms. We've already mentioned them before, but I just want to make sure everyone understands what I mean when I say this. The first one is metaphysics. Metaphysics is was first written about by Aristotle, and he actually didn't call it metaphysics. He had two sets of writings on the subject. One was physics, and then the other one was after physics. And his students said, well, physics came first, next is metaphysics. And what metaphysics is just a philosophical study of reality. There's a lot of definitions for it, but that one would be very good for us. So if I talk about metaphysics, I'm talking about the status of concrete reality. The other term is epistemology. Epistemology is simply the theory of knowledge. If I ask about your theory of knowledge, I want to know, what steps do you come to in order to know if something is true? And you'll see, like, throughout history that people have different epistemologies, because they're all trying to figure out or have a type of methodology to figure out what is true. So, skepticism, we're going to talk about that one a little bit more, so I'm not going to define it right now. If any other terms come up, you guys, feel free to raise your hand. It's not like classical sit in your pew church and don't talk. I care more about you learning than me hearing my own voice. In fact, I don't even like listening to my own voice. I go back through and listen to my sermons, not because I like the way I sound, I can't stand it at all, but I do it to critique myself and to make sure I'm being clear and preaching as fluently as I can. So, but every time I do, I just think, man, that guy sounds like a dork. but anyway, so yeah, feel free to ask questions. Okay. So there was a philosopher from the Platonic school of thought, or he studied, or his epistemology was that of Plato, and we'll talk about what that means in a little bit. Like many other prominent philosophers, he dealt with various issues. One of these issues was skepticism. This guy was influenced by the great medieval philosopher Augustine. Augustine also dealt with skepticism. In fact, Augustine has a great quotation on skepticism in which he says, if the skeptics say, what if you are mistaken? Well, if I am mistaken, I am. For if one does not exist, he can by no means be mistaken. Yeah, you know, I said before last time, I gave you that quotation about time where Augustine was like, yeah, I know what time is as long as you don't ask me to define it. Kind of, he's got that little witty humor. And his skeptics are going to Augustine and say, hey, Augustine, how do you know you're not mistaken about this whole skeptical thing? He's like, well, if I'm mistaken, then I'm a person who is mistaken, which means I exist. Unexistent things or non-existent things can't be mistaken. All they can do is be non-existent. So that was some of the things that influenced this guy. So this Platonic philosopher who fought skepticism was influenced by Augustine. He wanted to know what he could. He realized that accepting everything he saw, touched, or discerned would get him nowhere. He began to reject all that he could reject. He So this philosopher wanted to know everything that he possibly could know. But he realized that if he just knew things by accepting them, it would really get him nowhere, because everyone would accept these things. So instead of accepting them, he decides to reject everything. In this rejection, he came up with his famed dream argument. And in this, he says, there are times when I'm sleeping and I think that I'm awake. And I wake up and I realize, wow, I was just sleeping. Now, like, same thing as from the Matrix movies. If you've ever seen the Matrix movies, when they're in that environment where they're all plugged into the dreamlike world, and one of the characters says to the main character, have you ever been in a dream that you were so convinced was real? And he says, now, what if you never woke up from that dream? How could you discern the dreaming world from the real world? You can't. It's so awesome that this philosopher totally paved the way for the Matrix movies. That's pretty sweet. But yeah, so the dream argument says, if you've been confused as to the status of whether you're awake or asleep, how could you even be sure about the reality around us? Even the same thing, too. He actually started rejecting stuff that we would never even think to reject today. He rejected the sciences, physics, astronomy, medicine. He rejected everything because they could all be a part of this dream. He even goes on to say that it could be an illusion by an evil spirit. So there's this guy who doubted everything physical that he possibly could. He would doubt the chair that he sat on, that it was really there. He doubted the immaterial world, because it could all be an illusion. He doubted everything he could until he was only certain of one possible thing. He knew that there existed in himself a doubter. He could doubt everything. He could doubt what he saw. He could doubt what he touched. But the only thing he was sure of was that he doubted. And when he reached this conclusion, he said, cogito ergo sum. Or in his home language, je pense, donc je suis. I think, therefore I am. The famed French philosopher, René Descartes. Now Descartes, he started a bunch of stuff with this line of thinking. But if you realize what he was doing, it's very brilliant. He was doing it, it's kind of like an onion. He was like, I'm taking these layers of reality and I'm peeling them away. I'm peeling them away until I can reach this core and this foundation. This foundation that is absolutely immovable. Once I have reached this unmovable core, then I'm going to build my epistemology off. Once I have this irrefutable core, I'm going to build my theory of knowledge from that. And that's what Descartes did. He started with the absolute most simple premise there could be. And that is, I think, therefore I am. Now, this will really trip you out. But there are things that we can discern better than our own existence. And this is one of those truths. I think, therefore I am. And what I mean by that is, and I'll refute this probably next week. I'm not going to get into it today, but I'll let you kind of squirm with it a little bit maybe, is we could all be in the Matrix right now. We could all be brains in vats right now. We could be able to not believe everything we're seeing at all right now, but yet we can know that I think, therefore I am. So you actually can discern your own existence better than you can discern the environment around you. Actually, I'm going to talk about this a little bit more towards the end of the talk tonight, but I want you to kind of just put that in your head, because it's kind of trippy to think about. Okay, so the reason why he talked about this was actually to refute skepticism. Now, skepticism, again, means lack of knowledge. Now, most people, if you saw someone and he said, I doubt this, I doubt that, I doubt this, I doubt that, wouldn't you want to claim that that person is a skeptic? Yeah. So, should we say that Descartes was a skeptic? Absolutely not. And the reason why was, he is using doubts as a way to build knowledge. Remember I talked about the onion thing? He's tearing away layers to get at the core. So he's doubting to learn. He's doubting to build his epistemology. The skeptics you see, especially modern day, they don't doubt for those reasons. You know, I would talk real quick, do a little side note on classical skepticism. Classical skeptics were legitimate scholars. But there were some very good scholars. Two main types of classical skeptics are the Cartesians, and a lot of people will say that it was Descartes that started this whole Cartesian movement. They would say that you're really not justified in believing anything outside of your mind, like the cogito. Or the cogito is, I think, therefore I am. So they would say, you can't really be justified in believing anything outside of that. The other one, in preparing for today, I came across these. I never even heard of these guys before. It's called Pyrrhonisms. I've never even heard of them before. But the cool thing about these guys, I fell in love with these guys pretty quick because they hated speculative philosophy. And what I mean by that is these skeptics were skeptical about people that would advocate things that you couldn't prove. And what I mean by that is, you know, a lot of philosophers today, well, even like a lot of ethics today, it's just so unpractical. I mean, like, I always tell people will come up to me and they'll say the most ridiculous things to me, like, oh, you study philosophy? And most of the time when people ask me that question, I feel like, okay, what are they going to ask me? And sometimes they ask me the most bizarre things. They say, oh, you study philosophy? I'm like, yeah. What do you think about the whole Mayan calendar thing in 2012? Like, that's not a philosophical issue. Same thing. People will ask that all the time. But even ethics today. Ethics, the philosophical notion of ethics is more concerned with highly improbable ethical scenarios than it is about what it classically stood for. Classical ethics was basically, what can I put in my life to allow me to live the best possible life? Now you take an ethics class and people say, if the guy showed up at your door with a gun and said, is there anybody in the house because I'm going to kill him? And there are, and you say no. Does that mean you lied? You know, it's like, that doesn't really mean anything. But that's what ethics is today. These guys would absolutely hate stuff like that. They did not like speculative philosophy. They said, based on your evidence, why would you believe this? But the skepticism today is not like that. They're just saying, well, what if? Well, what if this? What if this? What if this? Having no evidence for that, but rather just wanting to say, well, what if? You know, modern day skepticism is more like a petulant child that says, you say to them, hey, time to go to bed. And they say, why? Because it's 9 o'clock. Well, why? Because our system of time says that 9 o'clock is about the time when you should go to bed. Why? You know, that's not skepticism. That's a child that needs to be punished. I never did that, did I? So, remember, Descartes was not a skeptic himself, but he used skeptical thoughts to bring him to a theory of knowledge. He would, like I said, he would break down those layers, and once broken down, he based his whole theory of knowledge from that. Now, I'll show you this real quick. If you guys have seen my flyers, This is pretty cool. This is the School of Athens by one of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Raphael. He's not really a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. You guys know that was the coolest thing growing up. Only way kids my age ever knew about Renaissance painters was from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. But anyways, this is Raphael's School of Athens. And the cool thing about this picture is you have Aristotle and Plato. And they are standing next to each other. And Aristotle is kind of going like this and is putting his hand like kind of halfway, pointing at the world around him, kind of. And Plato is pointing up. And if you study them, their epistemologies or their theories of knowledge differ on this subject. And Plato, he would say that the physical realm is less than real. He said that true reality existed in these immaterial forms. Like, for example, he would say the immaterial notion of this chair, the perfect chairness, was more real than even this physical chair. The reason why he said that is because this chair is changeable, it's finite, but the perfect immaterial notion of chairness is what's perfect. And Aristotle would totally disagree and say, no, it's like the trueness of reality and all motion comes from this physical plane. This is where reality lies. And from them, you can see these schools of thought progress all throughout, even to modern-day Christian scholars. There's modern-day Christian scholars that follow Plato as their epistemology, and there's some that follow Aristotle. I kind of don't really adhere to either. I kind of jump back and forth a lot. I like Plato's ideas on and how he influenced Augustine a lot. But I like Aristotle's view on ethics as well. But the one thing is so these guys talked about where the different realms of where truth is. Plato said, you know, the truth begins in this realm of ideas, and Aristotle says, no, it begins in the physical realm. I agree with Descartes in that we should start with the irrefutable idea and then base all of our knowledge from that. So essentially what I'm saying is, to answer the question I had you, I think, on where do we begin, truth or reality, I say you begin with truth. And the reason why we begin with truth is it is the irrefutable basis. Even if we can deny all the reality around us, we can be justified in these certain aspects of truth. Now, a lot of the Aristotelian scholars will, and I think this is a legitimate criticism too, is they will say, well, if you start in the realm of ideas, you could end in the realm of ideas. And what they mean by that is, if you start with just talking about ideas, how do we go from ideas to the physical world and interact with it? And that is a little bit of a problem, but next week when we start getting into what does it mean for something to be real and start defining reality, I'll teach you guys how it's really not that big of a shift. The last thing I want to talk about is just kind of clarify this real quick. Since all reality is denied except for the mind, we should begin with truth. There's literally an infinite amount of knowledge that can come about even if reality is fake. And what I mean by that is, again, if we're plugged into the matrix right now, 2 + 2 still equals 4. If I'm dreaming right now, 2 + 2 = 4. If a demon is controlling this whole environment and it's an illusion, 2 + 2 = 4. So there are truths that transcend any amount of perception. No matter what, despite what Big Brother says, 2 + 2 will never equal anything but 4. unless we redefine what two means and what plus means and two means and equals means and four means, 2 + 2 will always equal 4. Now, mathematical propositions like that, there's an infinite amount of them. So even that itself, there's enough to say, well, even if we don't know reality, we can, or even if we, if reality around us is fake, we can know certain truths. And there's other things too. When we talk about, when we go to define truth, there are four propositions about truth that we can know for sure. Now, we're not going to go into those now, but this is some more homework for you. What are these things that we can know about truth? If we can know nothing else about truth, what are the four things that we know about it? Now, there's one other thing I do want to talk about, because this kept on coming up when people mentioned reality and were trying to define reality to me and which one comes first, is there's a difference between, again, you're using those kind of those big terms, but there's a difference between metaphysical reality and epistemological reality. What do you think I mean by that? Mitch, what do you think is the difference between metaphysical reality and epistemological reality?
Define epistemological.
Theory of knowledge. Anybody? What I mean by that is, when I say metaphysical reality, I am talking about objective, concrete, unchanging reality, such as red is red. Now, we'll go into some like arguments. People say, well, why do we call that red? Or how do we know what is red? There's easy answers for that. We're going to talk about that soon. We're not going to talk about it tonight. When I talk about epistemological reality, I'm talking about stuff like the Mariners are the greatest baseball team ever to live. Or ever to exist. Now, in a sense, I think it's true that the Mariners are an awesome baseball team. But somebody else could say the Mariners are a bad baseball team. So that is epistemological reality, or based on truth, or based on knowledge, based on experience, based on whatever thing brings you to believe a certain thing. So there's different types of reality. In the sense, there's one reality, we'll talk about that next week, there's one reality, but there are certain things that are about reality that will never change, and there are certain things that are based on subjective preference, like if I were to say Star Wars is the best movie of all time, that's a subjective preference, me a subject preferring something. And, yeah, what's up?
Matt, there's two definitions to that. The word best jumps out at me. Is that a key word in the sense that one of them is more absolute than the other thing? It's using the word best, so the word best becomes another discussion, so you can't put these two truths together. I mean,
what do you mean?
Well, you use the word best for the Mariners.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now, I understand that is the truth. Now we have to say, wait a minute. Hold everything. Let's talk about what best means.
Yeah, and that's good. And that could be
people get arrested every night, or what? What is the? Is there such a word or lack of word in this other definition? Which I've
Well, it depends. If let's say the Mariners won the World Series last year, I could say, hey, the Mariners are the best because they won the World Series last year. That would still be in a sense a part of. The metaphysical reality of stuff that actually occurred, but that's still somewhat of a subjective preference
Okay, so that's subjective. We agree on that. What's this other definition which I've lost now?
The metaphysical.
Is there such a word in the definition of that of an example? You would give us an example of red is red, or how that. Where you get from on that one, I forget.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So
metaphysical
is
reality.
Word like best in that.
No.
Okay, that's.
It's just something is.
Okay, so I'm trying to make a distinction. To me, that jumps out at me. You use the word best in one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. It's something that it's beyond, I don't want to say contestation because people can test anything, but I would say, you know, a part of the metaphysical reality is like 2 plus 2 equals 4.
Okay, I think you used the word subjective, and I rolled right over. I think you were answering my question before you asked. Thank you.
And again, guys, this is tough stuff. Like, I want to talk like another half hour on this because I don't like leaving stuff open, but we're going to stop here because I don't want to throw too much at you. But essentially, and people might not all define these things the same, but when I say metaphysical reality, I am talking about reality apart from sensory perception, apart from opinion, apart from how you feel about it. Now, whether you like it or not, you know, we are in Washington State. Whether you like it or not, there's no elephant in the room right now. You know, there's a lot of things. And now, there's one thing, too, that people like to bring up is, well, what if there's someone in here that's a schizophrenic and they see someone standing next to me? We're going to go into that next week about how do we respond to that. If there's an objective reality, then how come we don't have, in a sense, equal access to it? We have some people that do think they, you know, see pink elephants flying around and stuff like that. So we'll talk about that next week. It's actually not a very big problem. And then when I talk about epistemological reality, I'm talking about based on your background, circumstances, temperament, education, you'll feel differently about different things. You know, it's like if you have a girl that grows up in a house like full of boys, you know, she'll probably grow up kind of rough and tough, you know, and get used to all the grittiness of boys and stuff like that. But if you have a girl that grows up in a house full of girls that's not used to that gruffiness of guys, they're going to have a different perception or a different experience if they were to come together and chat. You know, it's like the girl that's not used to boys say, you know, a boy should never, you know, mess with a girl or something like that. I'm like, yeah, but if I stole my brother's socks, they would tackle me and something like that. So that's not a very good example. I just thought of that off the top of my head. But so that's the main difference. Is there any other questions? Hey, Doc, do you have a question?
Yeah, man. I just wanted to say, you know, you're doing a great job, and hey, God bless you, and I don't like the Raiders no more.
Okay, Doc. Well, thanks for the advice, and yeah, go Seahawks. So, any other questions? I know guys, I say to you, I know it's kind of it might be a little frustrating for you guys to hear this stuff because I get excited by it because I'm a nerd. You know, and so you might not be a nerd, so you might not get excited by it. But it's a lot to take in, and it's a lot to understand. But once you guys see where I'm going with this, and once you realize how important to know what truth and what reality is, you'll realize, wow, Matt did know what he was talking about. He wasn't just up there talking about useless things for a half hour while I could be at home watching TV on a Sunday. So I challenge you guys, even if you're a little frustrated tonight, honestly, I'm a little frustrated tonight that I didn't think I explained some things as well as I would like to. But I challenge you guys, stick with it because this stuff is going somewhere, I promise. But just the main thing you need to take from today is we begin our quest for knowledge with the undeniable truth. And that is, we think, therefore we are. And then from that, we can build our whole theory of knowledge and what is real. And next week, we're going to go into defining what the real is. Defining the real is what next week is about. So we begin with truth, but once we begin with truth, we're still left to decide what's real. I think, therefore, I am, but here I am, this thinking being. I need to know where I inhabit or what's real or what's not real or even what does real mean. So next week we're going to get into defining the real, and yeah, we'll continue from there. Any other questions? Yeah.
What was the four things we needed to...
About truth, yeah. What if you were like a brain in a vat, you know, or in the matrix, and you had to discern four things about truth that were self-evident, like the cogito, I think, therefore I am, what are they? So, it's kind of fun. The reason, actually, let me say this real quick. I hate Ed when he writes his papers and he adds new information in his conclusion. I cross it out and throw an F and give it back to him. I do want to add one extra thing in my conclusion that's new. I'm going to define truth for you, and you'll know why. Even though we're saying we start with truth, we're going to talk about reality next week. The definition of truth is that which that corresponds with reality. The definition of truth is that which that corresponds with reality. Something is true if it goes along with or can be discerned in reality. Now, to the keen observer, the next question is, what is reality? What is real? And that's why next week we're going to define the real. All right. Take care, you guys. God bless you.